Coming to you from the ancestral territory of the Anishinaabe and the area inhabited by the Haudenosaunee and the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation, this is Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking. We hope to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance challenges concentrated economic and political power and instead champions an approach in which ownership is broadly distributed, institutions are humanly scaled, and decision-making is accountable to communities. I spoke with John Farrell, Energy Democracy Director and Co-Director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. But first, let's listen to a brief audio introduction as posted by the Institute for Local Self-Reliance.
When we start our day, we may not realize how each thing we do is part of the larger economy. We rarely think about where our dollars end up, but where they go has a big impact. Each year, more of our money goes to bigger and bigger businesses with growing economic and political power. These mega corporations bend the rules to benefit themselves at the expense of our communities. One organization is fighting back. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance works to rewrite the rules and to give communities the power to choose a different future. Across several vital economic sectors, we help break the corporate stranglehold that extracts wealth from our local economies and undermines our democracy. We advocate for community banks and credit unions that make productive loans to grow local business and community wealth. They thrive only when their community does too. Together, we fight the biggest banks that gamble with our money and ignore our needs. We champion locally owned businesses that create good jobs, healthy neighborhoods, and keep dollars in the community. Together, we fight giants like Walmart and Amazon that use their size to crush competition. We empower households and communities to take charge by producing their own energy from the wind and sun. Together, we fight utility companies that keep investing in big, dirty power plants that use last century's technologies. We champion reuse, recycling, and composting. We enable communities to shift from waste to wealth, creating local manufacturing, rich and resilient soils, and a healthier climate. Together, we fight the big corporations that kill jobs and profit from burning or burying valuable materials. We inspire hundreds of communities to build their own internet networks. These lightning-fast networks lower prices, improve customer service, and supercharge innovation. Together, we fight large cable and telephone monopolies that deliver awful service at skyrocketing prices. Mega corporations have their own plans for extracting our community's wealth. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance helps communities use their authority to choose their own path. Reclaiming control won't automatically solve our problems, but it can allow us to build a more resilient and sustainable economy that creates opportunity for all.
I'm speaking with John Farrell, the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Welcome to Earth Matters, John, and we'll start off very briefly, just tell us about ILSR, as its acronym is. It was founded in 1974, and take it away from there.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. The really short explanation of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance is that we build local power by helping to oppose corporate concentration in the economy, and so that we are looking at all of the different ways that we can help communities have more control over their local economy and push back against the consolidation of power into very large institutions.
That is quite an endeavor. And give me an idea of what resources you have. Are you for-profit, non-profit, charitable organization?
Yeah, so we're a non-profit organization. I think a think tank is a pretty good explanation of how we work, that we are both, but we are both grounded in our connections with entrepreneurs and city officials and activists as well as deep into kind of the economic and policy issues that underlie how economies work and how communities can have more power and structure around their economy. So we're a nonprofit organization primarily funded by private foundations, but also a significant amount of our money comes from individual contributions from supporters.
Is it fair to ask, are you anti-globalization or are you just more focused on the local community environment?
I think the best word to describe how we approach globalization is one that comes actually out of the Catholic religion called subsidiarity, which is the idea that we make decisions closest as close as we can to the people who are impacted by them. And so our struggle with globalization is the way in which it tends to remove decision-making power from local communities and to centralize it in places where they don't have access to that decision-making power. So if we are talking about globalization in terms of information sharing, then we're all for it because we think communities across the globe should have access to the information and the tools to better themselves. But when it comes to globalizing the rules of the economy in a way that strips away local authority, we oppose that.
Now, when the organization was founded in 1974, I'm going to imagine its goals or ambitions might have been a little different. How has it evolved since the 70s? I mean, that's quite a while ago. So how has it evolved since then?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that's interesting about being at this organization where I've been for over 10 years now is how much the focus that we have on lifting up local decision-making power and fighting corporate concentration has remained a consistent theme. Well, I think one of the things that has changed over this time is the state of the global and the United States economy within which we are advocating for that. So in the 1970s, we were at the end of a very long run, starting with the New Deal, or even a little bit before that, of active government intervention in the economy to ensure competition, to ensure that institutions and corporations were not too large and that there was a competitive environment by ensuring that you couldn't get too big, you know, that it would limit mergers, it would limit acquisitions of companies, it would limit the conglomeration of power in a way that both preserved competitiveness in the political sphere and in the economic sphere. So you don't have massive corporations also being very involved in politics. And what's changed over the last 40 to 45 years where we've been around is we've been building up and have always had and have very consistently had an interest from communities in what are the tools that we can use to build up more of our own local economy. And that hasn't changed at all. But what has changed is that the federal government in particular has kind of given up on its role of ensuring a competitive environment. And that's where we're now seeing these concerns about Facebook or Google or Amazon or Walmart, all of these very large corporate institutions that have enormous economic and political power, and how that really, we have to confront that in order to effectively help communities have some self-determination, because if these institutions continue to grow, there's simply no way that there are enough things that they can do at a local level to combat that.
Considering a number of multinationals have bigger GDPs than many nation states, it's a good cry to go against the monopolization of environments. You have a number of different initiatives that you're focused on. One is banking, broadband, internet, composting, energy, your area of expertise, waste, and community-based businesses. I want to focus on a couple because that's a lot to approach, but I want to drill down a little bit on the community-based business and specifically what ILSR is doing with regard to Amazon. So can you give us an idea of what's going on there?
Yeah, so what I would say, there are a few different pieces and roles that we're playing here. What this comes out of is our longstanding interest in elevating independent businesses in communities. So the idea of non-chain stores, chains that are locally owned, chains that therefore have owners who are invested in their communities and tend to give back, and many more of the dollars that customers spend at those stores stay within the community. And Amazon, like other large internet retailers presents a really significant threat. But Amazon is a unique threat to the local economy in the sense that it also is, it's not just a retailer itself, because it sells many items under its own brand, but it's also the platform, the e-commerce platform. And the really stunning thing is that about one out of every $2 that we spend online or searches that we do online to do purchases online goes to Amazon or goes through Amazon's platform. And the problem is that because they control the platform, they're able to bias it in favor of their own things. So there's a number of things that we've uncovered in our research about how Amazon games the system to favor their own products. Maybe it's by using their platform, they raise fees on other sellers and make it harder for them to compete. Or they use the information that they have about their competitors because they're using Amazon's platform to introduce their own items and then undercut those sellers by promoting their items first in the search results on Amazon. So there are many, many ways in which it's able to exercise market power that really threatens any competitors, even large brick and mortar stores, chain stores, but especially independent businesses for whom it's so important to have access to internet sales, but who they can't really compete effectively with Amazon when it comes to that platform.
So what can the average citizen do? I mean, we're pretty much addicted to going online and searching for something, and even to the point where I might want to go to a local bookstore, but it just seems so easy and simple to, with a few clicks and a few days later, I've got a book in my mailbox as opposed to going to the bookstore. They might not have it. They have to order it and it comes in a few weeks later. How do we fight that?
Well, that's a really good point. And I think this is really the challenge of Amazon and of the story of corporate concentration in our economy is that it really pushes up, you know, we're really struggling between different values here. And convenience is the value I think that many Americans are operating under when they choose to shop at Amazon, and especially with the Prime membership. And that's what Amazon is all about. They offer this Prime membership, which probably doesn't really effectively pay for the cost of the service that it provides in terms of inexpensive shipping and access to all these other services. But what it does do is it means a customer almost always starts their search for internet shopping or for shopping in general at Amazon.com. And that's what they want. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a couple things you can do. One is, you know, at a personal level, you can look for alternatives. So if you like books a lot, if you like shopping for books, try a website like IndieBound, which is a coalition site of independent booksellers who can help you find an item just as well as Amazon, whether or not it's in stock at your local bookstore, and get it shipped to you. Or even try calling up your local bookstore. I think one of the things I find that's amazing is Stacey Mitchell, who does a lot of our research on Amazon, lives in Portland, Maine, talks about how she has a good relationship with the folks at her local bookstore. She'll call them up, ask for a book, and they will either like package it up for her if she's giving it as a gift, have it ready for her at the counter if she stops by, or they can also, you know, deliver it locally to her home. So they have a lot of options and services like that that might be more personal than you would get online. But there really are limits to what you can do as an individual. And what we really need to see here is activity by the federal and state governments to intervene in this situation of corporate dominance and to say, look, we can't have someone be both the platform provider for e-commerce and a competitor on that platform. And that's actually an issue that plays out across a lot of the other initiatives and the work that we do. And what the best way I think of to consider this is, we have public roads, which are really crucial arteries of commerce throughout our system, right? They're used for all sorts of things. They're used for individuals to travel, for businesses to travel, for industry. And we pay for them collectively, and everybody can use them without discrimination, whether it's delivery services like the Postal Service or UPS or DHL or anybody. And that's the kind of platform that we need electronically as well to make sure that everybody has access to the marketplace in a non-discriminatory way. And that's really the role of the government to step in and do that. It is not something that individuals can, even if many of them make choices individually, can accomplish.
What about the democracy of the economy, whereas co-ops, for example, or worker-owned facilities, does that not drive the consumption locally if more and more people are employed in employee-owned entities? Is that not a route to go?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of evidence about our economy that suggests that as we allow institutions and corporations to get bigger and more remote, it has a number of different effects. One is that it exacerbates inequality because the range of pay between the corporate CEO and the lowest paid worker at a very large company tends to be a much wider spread. It exacerbates the flow of dollars out of a lot of communities and concentrated into particular communities. So like with Walmart, you know, the corporate headquarters is in one state, but they have stores operating in all 50 states. And so all of those dollars are flowing from so many different places and then into one very specific place. And so that's, you know, one issue in terms of size. And then, of course, there's that issue raised here about cooperatives and about ownership, that we have ways to structure ownership of our economy around cooperatives. You see this with, for example, like credit unions, which are a very substantial portion of our lending economy. And it's the members of these financial institutions that are actually the owners that get the, you know, financial benefits if the credit union is doing well. It's actually a fairly significant portion of our energy sector, where most of the rural United States gets their electricity from rural electric cooperatives, which are owned by the members who are also the customers. And so there's and this is also a fairly big piece of our agricultural economy. A lot of cooperatives in agriculture, farmers banding together to get better prices for their crops. So there are many ways, I think, in which we can think about restructuring the economy and restructuring ownership of the economy, localizing it, changing it to look at cooperatives and other forms of ownership to retain more of the dollars in the economy within the communities.
Mm-hmm. As a slight tangent to that, I'm going to take a quote from your website. Dollar stores feed more Americans than Whole Foods. And these are the discount dollar stores that we see pop up everywhere. What's the challenge with that? And what's the impact of that?
So I think this is a really powerful illustration, especially because it illustrates in some ways the divide that we have between different places in our economy. So there's a lot of folks who live in urban areas where you won't find a dollar store potentially, but you will find Whole Foods. And obviously it's an expensive place to shop, relatively speaking, whereas a dollar store obviously is targeting low cost. But it's also a big difference and a big divide in terms of the quality and the variety of things that you can buy there. And so a dollar store is not really a full service grocery store. It doesn't have access to all the fresh and healthy foods that people generally need in the way that a Whole Foods store might be. And so it really highlights the inequality in our economy in a lot of different ways. And ironically, both of these kinds of stores, dollar stores and Whole Foods stores, are big chain stores. And so they're both part of a problem in which our economy is being taken over by institutions that are very large and often global. You know, Whole Foods now being owned by Amazon, for example, dollar stores being this, you know, enormous chain stores across our economy. And the thing that that we need to do about it is to figure out how do we plan at a local level where we can make decisions about what kind of stores we want and how they service our communities. How do we plan in a way that makes sure that the kind of commercial businesses that we have actually serve the needs of the community? And this is a really challenging thing. I think there's this notion that the market will work as it's supposed to, and that businesses will come into communities to serve the needs that those communities have. And I think one of the things that we're learning through our research is you actually have to be a little bit more thoughtful and planful if you want to make sure that communities have access to the things they need. You know, we've had this notion being bandied about now for quite some time about food deserts, areas of the country where you can't really get access to fresh food because of the way that, you know, big box stores like Walmarts or other big grocers have knocked out independent grocery stores that used to be smaller and serve communities. And so I think there's a lot of challenges there highlighted by the divide between those two, but they're both an issue in terms of the way that we have access to both competitive markets for food services, as well as making sure that we have access in all communities to fresh and healthy food.
The Institute for Local Self-Reliance does analysis involved in policy, as you mentioned, has grassroots assistance. There's a wealth of information on your website, ilsr.org. And one of the things I want to talk about is the energy democracy, you call it. Tell us about that local energy drive that, again, sort of echoes what the consumption side of things are, is that you're looking at creating local self-reliance as far as energy is concerned. Why is that important?
Yeah, I mean, what we are witnessing in the energy sector, and especially the electricity sector, is really a once in a generation, a once in a hundred years transformation of the system. And most people think of that as a tension between fossil fuels and renewable energy resources like wind or solar power. But it's also playing out in a way about the scale and ownership of the system, that in a way that many people don't notice. And that's really about the fact that these renewable energy resources that we have are much more distributed by nature, or much smaller in size. So, a single gas power plant might provide enough power for 50 or 100,000 homes. A single wind turbine powers about 200 homes. And so you build a whole bunch of them. But you can build a large wind farm with hundreds of turbines, or a small one with just a handful. And the same thing is true with solar panels. You know, the exact same solar panels that someone might have on their rooftop, you know, that I have on my roof, are the ones that are used in giant utility scale solar power plants. But it can be built at any scale. And so what we have happening in the energy sector is this really remarkable opportunity to transform how we spend our energy dollars. Whereas, 50 to 100 years ago, it really made sense to concentrate the capital in the electricity business to build very large, very economical power plants. These days, we have access to many different choices, whether that's producing energy on our own rooftop, or doing it like on a community scale project that would be on the rooftop of a local church, or maybe out in an unused field of a farm near an urban area. So there are many different ways that we can structure the generation of electricity to serve our needs in the 21st century. And this is a real opportunity that we have to both transform our energy system from dirty to clean, but also to transform it from monopoly ownership and concentrated wealth to distributed and democratic ownership.
Let's talk about the organization itself. You've got offices across the United States. Tell us where they are and, give us an idea of how large ILSR is. How many people have you got employed?
Yeah, so we have offices. Our home offices are in Washington, D.C. and Minneapolis, Minnesota. We have another small office in Portland, Maine, and actually several other employees who are scattered around different parts of the country and work primarily remotely. It's really only about 20 people. It's give or take. Sometimes we've got interns. People come and go from time to time. But we're relatively small. We like to joke that we punch above our weight, but we are really strongly focused on producing the analysis and the research and the tools that help communities do better. And we really rely on, and I think our success is both in terms of building a strong reputation for doing nonpartisan and original objective research, but also through partnering effectively with advocacy organizations, with local governments, with local businesses across the country, to work with them in getting these tools and these resources out to folks who can use them.
John, tell us how people can find out more about your organization.
Well, you kindly already mentioned our website, and that's probably the best place to find more information, ilsr.org, where you can see information across all of our initiatives about how we are trying to fight corporate concentration and build local power. If you like listening for information, not only this podcast, but we have several podcasts that we produce. Our premier one is called Building Local Power and focuses on this issue of corporate concentration in particular. But we also have podcasts in our composting and energy and broadband programs that get more into those particular ones, telling stories about the work that's being done there as well. And then you can also find us often doing presentations across the country as well, as we get invited to communities to talk about the opportunities to build local power and to advance local self-reliance.
John Farrell, Institute for Local Self-Reliance co-director, thank you very much for speaking with us and Earth Matters. We've just scratched the surface, so I really encourage people to check out your website, find out more, support, and even donate to your organization.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Lawson Hunter here, host and producer of Earth Matters. I wanted to thank all the listeners of Earth Matters for your continuing support. As always, please feel free to send us your comments, suggestions, and thoughts on topics and people we should look at for future programs. Email us at earthmatters@newsandcomment.com, newsandcomment.com, or follow us on Twitter at earthmatters3. I'd also like to encourage you to like, rate, and share Earth Matters with others so that our work can reach a larger audience. Thanks for listening. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and reports on solutions and alternatives that help protect and preserve a healthy planet.